Operation Epic Fury was a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield.
Was it?
A capital V military victory.
You sure about that, Pete? You sure we're not going back in?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We'll see.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us again today. Good to have you with us. It was quite the roller coaster ride on yesterday's show with the deadline ticking down over the hour to Trump's threats of massive war crimes, including genocide against Iran. That was fun, wasn't it, Des?
If you want to call it that.
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Trump vowing to destroy Iran's civilian power plants and bridges and end it as a civilization. Quote, never to be brought back again, he vowed. Only for Trump to, as we had largely suggested was likely to happen, come up with a reason to change course at the last second, as he did. And as announced just moments before we went off air from yesterday's show. Not that I'm complaining. Glad to see him stand down, at least for now. The supposed two-week ceasefire deal struck with Iran to allow Trump to back off of his promised genocide included, among other things, an agreement to let Iran continue to control the Strait of Hormuz and, in fact, charge vessels for crossing through it, which had never been they'd never been able to do before Trump's war, all in exchange for Trump backing down on his promised attack. There is more, which Team Trump is hoping to spin into some kind of a win for our quickly deteriorating mental case of a president, as you heard Pete Hegseth there at the top of the show mention. We will discuss all of that with our guests shortly, even as the ceasefire and supposed reopening of traffic through the strait now appears to be shaky at very best at this hour, with reports that Iran has already closed the strait again, if it even reopened it. All of this in light of Israel's continuing massive bombing of Lebanon on Wednesday morning, and the U.S. appearing to sort of deny all of it or something. We'll try to make sense of all of this as much as we can with Nicholas Grossman, international relations professor and national security expert, joining us momentarily. But if you've had it with Trump-Republican wars, well, Tuesday was a very good day for entirely different reasons. It was election day this week in a number of states and localities across the country, with a lot of eyes on two key races in particular, as I have yet to come across any major voting or tabulation problems on Tuesday. I'm happy to say we can get right to the results here. And for those interested in American democracy over autocracy, I think the results were, yes, very encouraging once again. Trump-endorsed Republican Clay Fuller won Marjorie Taylor Greene's former U.S. House seat in a special election runoff in Georgia on Tuesday, turning back a Democratic challenge and all amid concern over the war in Iran. Why is that good news? Well, Fuller defeated the Democratic cattle farmer and retired Brigadier General Sean Harris by nearly 12 points, what would be considered a huge victory by most standards in most congressional districts. But Georgia's 14th congressional district is the reddest congressional district in the Peach State. It's up in the northwest corner of the state, borders Alabama and Tennessee, just to give you an idea of how much, you know, sort of smack dab in the middle of rural Trump country this is. It is, or at least was, a deep red district that Marjorie Taylor Greene had won by 29 points back in 2024. Donald Trump carried it by almost 37 points that same year. The Republican Fuller appears on track to win it by just under 12 points.
Wow, that's a big closing of that gap.
That's a 17-point swing toward the Democratic candidate as compared to Greene's victory just 2 years ago, and a 25-point swing toward the Democrat as compared to Donald Trump's win that very same year. Nonetheless, a loss is a loss, and the Democrats lost. But in a state like the closely divided battleground of Georgia, with a critical U.S. Senate race coming up there this November, where Democrat John Ossoff is seeking re-election, well, Democrats cannot be anything but elated by the results in the state's most Republican U.S. House district on Tuesday. To give you an idea of how bad it was for Republicans, despite winning the seat on Tuesday, I concede. But every single county in that district, there are 10 of them, every single county saw huge swings towards the Democrat. Every single one, anywhere from 20 to 30 point swings toward the Democrat in a race where he was running against a Trump-endorsed Republican. That includes some of the most conservative areas of the district, like Murray County, which voted for the Republican Fuller over Harris by 52 points. Well, even in Murray County, they moved 20 points toward the Democrat as compared to the presidential results back in 2024. Chattooga County voted for Fuller over Harris on Tuesday by 40 points, but that was, in fact, a 25-point increase for the Democrat in that county as compared to the last presidential race in the same district. And it's not just the Democrats who, you know, decided to come out in Republican areas, or the Republicans flipped to voting for a Democrat, per se. In Cobb County, the only county, the only one in the district that actually was won by the Democrat, Sean Harris, on Tuesday, he won it by 15 points. Well, there as well, there was a 24-point shift toward the Democratic candidate, as opposed to 2 years ago when Trump was on the ballot, which he decidedly will not be, at least not literally, during this November's critical midterm elections. In other words, Democrats lost the special election, but they won everywhere across that district by way of bellwether, in any event, for this fall in a state, a closely divided state like Georgia. As Politico reported it, quote, a Georgia Democrat slashed Trump's margin of victory by 2/3 in the state's reddest district, despite losing the election, the most significant overperformance that the party has seen across all 7 House special elections so far this cycle. So that loss is somewhat deceptive if you don't look at the numbers. Fuller will now serve out the Republican here, will now serve out the remaining months of Marjorie Taylor Greene's term through the end of the year, bolstering the Republicans' incredibly slim majority right now in the House, where Republicans control 217 seats to 214 for the Democrats, with one independent. Fuller will have to face another Republican primary, however, just next month on May 19, when he's running for a full 2-year term. He could face a June 16 party runoff as well. Meanwhile, Sean Harris, on the other hand, who previously ran for the seat against Marjorie Taylor Greene back in 2024 as well, and who obviously made substantial gains between then and this week, well, he is already the Democratic nominee for November for that full 2-year term.
So he won't have to do quite as much campaigning or spending quite as much money.
Correct. Harris said optimistically on Tuesday in Rome, Georgia, quote, we're going to beat him next time. Fuller, on the other hand, said that he had withstood Democrats' best punch. Quote, the left did their best. They poured in millions upon millions of dollars, Fuller said. And what you're seeing is the best that they can accomplish. Well, we will see, but it does seem like they did pretty good this time, though Green, by the way, did not endorse anyone in the race. Trump did. He posted, you know, in support of Fuller on both Monday night and again on Tuesday night, but the results suggest that voters are not particularly happy with him for some odd reason. Fuller, in turn, has backed Trump to the hilt, including on the war, which Marjorie Taylor Greene has been highly critical of during the campaign. Fuller was unable to identify any single issue on which he disagreed with the president. But the news for Democrats, including small D Democrats, was brighter still, perhaps in another longtime battleground state, the great state of Wisconsin on Tuesday, where the Democratic Party backed Chris Taylor, a liberal Wisconsin judge, won a seat on the state Supreme Court in the latest strong election for liberals since President Donald Trump's return to office. Taylor, a former Democratic state rep and current state appellate judge, easily defeated conservative appeals court judge Maria Lazar, who had been backed by Republicans in the race, for the 10-year term on the state's high court, where liberals had struggled for years under hard right control by Republican-backed state justices with a seemingly ironclad grip on the majority there, and the will to use it, frankly, to help Republicans and their hard right ideology. But Democrats continued to fight year after year through incredibly tight elections in a state long known for tight elections to finally win back a narrow majority on the 7-seat court back in 2023 when they flipped the court to a 4-3 majority. Finally, the election on Tuesday was to fill the seat of one of the court's right wingers, so liberals would have held on to the majority no matter what, no matter had they won or lost. But Taylor's win now expands the liberal majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court to a 5-2 split. Moreover, Taylor's win on Tuesday was enormous by Wisconsin election standards, especially Wisconsin Supreme Court election standards, frankly, by any state standards, but especially in the Badger State. With their, you know, closely divided elections, Taylor defeated her Republican-backed opponent by more than 20 points.
Wow.
It's about 60% to just under 40%, according to the reported tally as of Wednesday afternoon.
That seems decisive.
Yes, it certainly does. Now, we've covered Wisconsin Supreme Court races very closely over the years at bradblog.com and here on the Bradcast. For years, GOP-backed candidates have not been able to win a Wisconsin Supreme Court victory at this point since their narrow 6,000-vote win back in 2019. And in the years since, liberal judges Jill Karofsky, Janet Protasiewicz, Susan Crawford, and now Taylor have romped to easy wins ever since that, ever since 2019, amid an electorate that is apparently trending firmly to the left, at least in Wisconsin spring elections. Assuming every justice finishes out their terms at this point, the win now locks in a liberal court majority in the Badger State until at least 2030. This year's election attracted far less attention than the one last year that you may recall, where Crawford beat her conservative opponent by more than 10 points. That race, you might remember, saw Elon Musk, the world's richest man, Republican mega donor, racist drama queen, pour millions into an effort to defeat Crawford, arguing that the fate of, quote, Western civilization was at stake in that race. Well, the fate of Western civilization, which, while perhaps at threat these days, it certainly ain't because of the liberals holding the majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. If Musk is really worried about that, he might want to have a chat with the guy that he spent $1 billion on to help put into the White House 2 years ago. But the Wisconsin court's liberals have made good use of their majority in recent years, as Politico observes. Back in 2023, the court ordered new, yes, frankly, rather conservative state legislative maps for Wisconsin, effectively ending an outright GOP gerrymander that was instituted under the hard right then Governor Scott Walker. That gerrymander had lasted over a decade. It kept Republicans in complete control of the otherwise closely divided state, allowing them to institute these hard right anti-union, anti-abortion, anti-freedom policies. Well, last July, the new liberal court majority overturned Wisconsin's 176-year-old abortion ban by their newly gained 4-3 majority. Also last year, the court ruled that Democratic Governor Tony Evers could use his veto pen to lock in a 400-year increase in funding for schools, that to prevent Republicans in the future from gutting education. So, yeah, he was allowed to do that thanks to this Supreme Court majority. Elections and voting matter. All of this, notes Alex Burness at Bolts Magazine, before next year, when Wisconsinites will do all of this all over again, when one of the two, the court's now two remaining conservative justices, Annette Ziegler, when her seat comes up for re-election, she has already said that she is not seeking re-election. This gives liberals in the state an opportunity to expand their majority even further, potentially to a 7-1 margin next year. So really just a remarkable turnaround for a state which, as noted, we have been covering Supreme Court elections there for years, and the far right has had such a lock on it for so long. It seemed unbreakable. But with years of Wisconsin Democratic voters sticking with it, working hard, getting back to it after a loss, you know, things have very much changed right now in one of our great liberal progressive states. Elections and voting matter every time, everywhere. And by the way, I have to get to my guest here, but there were also a number of school board elections on Tuesday in Wisconsin and some other states. As Dan Nishanian reports, liberal candidates swept the 6 school board seats on the ballot in Elmbrook and Menominee Falls. Those are two districts, school districts within Wisconsin's once very conservative Waukesha County. Indeed, they ousted 2 conservative incumbents in those races. Also in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Democrats flipped a school board seat in Tulsa.
Yay.
Ousting a right-wing board member who had suggested that immigrant children endanger other kids. And earlier this decade in Missouri, Nishanian notes, the right took over the Francis Howell School Board in a large district in the St. Louis suburbs. After that takeover, there were book bans, restrictive policies on LGBTQ students were put in place. Well, on Tuesday night, the slate that was endorsed by the teachers, they swept. And the last remaining so-called conservative was ousted from that school board in Missouri.
Good.
Elections matter. And had, frankly, more folks realize that in 2024, well, we might not be in the mess that we're in now, not just in this country, but across the globe. To that end, let's take a quick break here. And the great international policy expert, Nicholas Grossman of the University of Illinois, will join us to try to help us make sense of whatever the hell is now going on in Iran. Ceasefire? No ceasefire? Straight open? Straight not open? I don't know. We'll find out. Maybe. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Well, Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The United States and Iran separately claimed victory late on Tuesday after President Donald Trump agreed to pause what he had promised would be civilization-ending genocidal strikes against the Persian Gulf nation. The ceasefire, with Trump seemingly desperate to make a deal of some sort, of almost any sort, it seems, was supposed to last for 2 weeks, allowing for completion of what the administration described as just a few final details before committing to a full agreement, if you have reason to believe any of that. Former Fox News co-host turned Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth described it this way on Wednesday morning.
Operation Epic Fury was a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield. A capital V military victory.
Was it? Was it, Pete? Well, maybe. With that announcement, the stock market soared and oil prices fell on the news on Wednesday, at least for the moment. Uncertainty in the region persists after Iran, the UAE, and Kuwait all reported attacks hours after the agreement was announced. Israel continued its massive bombing campaign against Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in southern Lebanon, and details related to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz remained, to say the least, unclear at this hour. The tenuous two-week ceasefire was being tested on Wednesday, less than a day after it began, in particular by uncertainty over the status of the strait and Israel's continued punishing attacks in Lebanon. Pakistan, which mediated the truce, and Iranian officials insisted that the agreement covered Lebanon, where Israel has targeted the Hezbollah militant group. Israel declared that they would agree to the two-week ceasefire, but only in Iran, not Lebanon. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, threatened a military response against, quote, aggressors in the region if the attacks did not end immediately. But Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary on behalf of Donald Trump, told reporters that Lebanon was not covered by the agreement. She also rejected reports that the strait, which Trump had insisted be reopened as a condition of the ceasefire, had been closed by Iran in response to the continued attacks, where roughly 20% of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas passes through the narrow waterway. Leavitt insisted that more vessels were getting through since the start of the ceasefire, even as shipping monitors did not show an increase in traffic on Wednesday. Further highlighting the fragility of the truce, Persian Gulf countries continued to report dozens of Iranian missiles and drone attacks on Wednesday. And Iran's state media reported that an oil refinery on Lavan, an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf, was struck by unspecified, quote, enemies. But there was at least a period of respite for Iran after Trump seemed to climb down from his threats of wiping out the entire Iranian civilization by Tuesday night of this week, threats that are themselves arguably war crimes. And whether the temporary truce announced on Tuesday night, just hours before Trump's promised genocidal threat, can actually hold, well, that might hang on whether, yes, the strait is opened or not, which seems unclear at this hour. The agreement announced on Tuesday night would have allowed Iran to charge a $2 million toll on each ship passing through it, which Trump seemed to agree to, even though ships passed through the strait for free prior to Trump's war. But even that agreement seems to be unclear as of Wednesday. Asked if the U.S. is opposed to Iran charging tolls for passage through the strait on Wednesday, Leavitt at the White House said the ceasefire deal is, quote, subject to the free, safe, and immediate reopening of the strait. Quote, I think the president was very clear and simplistic in his language last night, she said, adding that the strait's reopening must, quote, be without limitation, including tolls. But her assessment appeared to contradict remarks by Trump himself made to ABC News' Jonathan Carl earlier in the day. The president reportedly told Carl the U.S. is considering a, quote, joint venture with Iran to charge tolls. Quote, He's okay with the Iranians charging a toll for all ships that go through the Strait of Hormuz. Carl reported on Twitter that the president had told him, and that there might even be a joint U.S.-Iran venture to do it. Quote, "We're thinking of doing it as a joint venture," Trump said. "It's a way of securing it, also securing it from lots of other people," Carl said Trump told him, adding, quote, "It's a beautiful thing." Okay. On Tuesday night, Trump said a 10-point plan, supposedly from Iran, was a, quote, "workable basis on which to negotiate a lasting end to the war," after previously insisting for weeks that, quote, "there will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender." Iranian officials who did not surrender, unconditionally or otherwise, were triumphant on Tuesday, with the country's vice president saying on social media that, quote, the era of Iran had begun after Trump failed to destroy the Islamic Republic's government. Now, setting aside for the moment whether the Tuesday night agreement holds, as Ben Rhodes, an Obama-era National Security Council official, characterized it on Wednesday on Twitter, quote, "in the best-case scenario, Trump struck a deal to reopen a strait that was open before the pointless war he started, with the IRGC demonstrating its control over the strait and potentially extracting fees plus sanctions relief. Thousands of innocents, including hundreds of children, dead in Lebanon and Iran for no reason. U.S. troops killed and wounded. U.S. embassies and bases in the Middle East badly damaged. U.S. standing in the world obliterated. U.S. munitions badly depleted. Hundreds of billions spent, prices up everywhere, more global economic fallout to come, Putin strengthened and enriched, just a catastrophic situation, even in the best of circumstances, a profoundly shameful episode in American history, no matter what happens next. Indeed, the U.S. has seen 13 soldiers killed, depleted its military resources, sent prices of gas and goods through the roof, spent tens of billions on a war, to arrive at a situation where Iran is now charging $2 million per ship to pass through the strait, if they allow them at all, prompting one commenter in response to Rhodes to ask, when will the winning ever stop? Last week, at his ARC Digital newsletter and MS Now, University of Illinois International Relations professor, national security and terrorism insurgency expert, Nicholas Grossman argued that there was, quote, no off-ramp in sight for Trump's war. That, he said, while Donald Trump reportedly told his aides he is willing to end the Iran war while Iran still controls the Strait of Hormuz, he said that a closed strait blocking energy shipments is other countries' problems. He told interviewers that the strait will, quote, automatically open when the U.S. leaves, you know, just the way that he told us that COVID would magically disappear at some point. But last week, at least, Trump believed the war would not last, quote, too much longer because, quote, it's a total obliteration. The obliteration, it seems, is to Trump's reputation and the United States' standing in the world, however. Not so much in Iran, at least as of this moment, at least as far as I can tell. Quote, Trump has gotten America into a bad strategic position, wrote Grossman, and no matter how hard he wishes or how forcefully he lies, it looks like there is no good way out. Joining us now is Nicholas Grossman, I'm sure with an apology, given the very good way out that Donald Trump and his administration seem to be cleanly wrapping up their little excursion, as Trump called it, in Iran. Professor Grossman, sir, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me. And yes, it was I realized it was a little awkward writing something called no off-ramp and then the U.S. president announces an off-ramp. I don't think it's my argument was wrong, and for two reasons. One is that this problem is really not going away, that Iran has already. The war itself has disrupted a lot of global energy supplies. Iran is still choking traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. If they are charging, and they will get tons of revenue from this, but they really do seem like they want to charge people to get through, then they have to keep it closed for everybody else. So all of that is ongoing, and all of that continues to be America's problem, because it will affect the global economy and the American economy, make the prices of everything higher. It's already doing that, and we should probably expect more of that. The other way is that, to the extent Trump took an off-ramp, it was basically by surrendering and dropping all U.S. goals and saying, at least to Pakistani mediators, that, sure, the U.S. will give Iran everything they want. And I think this is most likely the way they set it as a basis for negotiation, or accepting it as a framework for negotiation, is that the Trump administration didn't really intend to give Iran all of this. Maybe they're telling themselves that if they just get to negotiations, that they can somehow get Iran to give up a bunch of stuff, even though Iran is in a stronger position based on its control of the Strait and its ability to survive the American bombardment. But if we go by just what the U.S. had agreed to so far, and that the Pakistani mediators say the U.S. had agreed to, it would be almost a total American surrender, giving Iranians everything they want and getting nothing the U.S. wanted, and leaving the United States in a decently weaker geostrategic position than before the war started.
Yeah, and I was being a little snarky there about the no off-ramp in sight, because I think that was true last week, and I think it's arguably true even now, even if we want to call this an off-ramp. I mean, if this is what amounts to an off-ramp, Nicholas, it seems to be one that's leaving Iran better off on the world stage than they were at the beginning of the conflict. Crippling sanctions on their oil sales and production has been lifted. They've got control of the Strait. They're charging people to travel through it. And apparently there is nothing in the agreement, as I understand it, that would either limit their long-range missile production or drone production or enrichment of uranium toward a potential creation of nuclear weapons. So am I reading all of that the same way you are? And if so, if that is the case, even if the ceasefire holds, et cetera, I mean, is there anything that we can say that Trump has actually won in this war?
No. So I'm reading it the same way that you are. I think that there is no other way to read it, and that part of the problem is different parties are saying different things. So I think that probably the Pakistanis, being the mediators in this, are being honest about what at least different parties said to them. But the U.S. and Iran are saying wildly different things. And as you noted, there's nothing about, in any of the talk of ceasefire, nothing about any missile restrictions, any nuclear restrictions, any restrictions on Iran supporting terrorism, any sacrifice by Iran at all, except to allow ships to both ceasefire that they're supposed to stop shooting also, and to allow ships to go through the Strait, which was allowed before the start of the war. And so if
except
it does freeze
get,
here...
Except now they get money. When they
right, and they would get a lot. And to put that in perspective, it would amount to something like $100 billion a year.
Wow.
And $100 billion a year is about the entire Iranian government budget for 1 year. And if we think back to when the Obama nuclear deal was facing a lot of criticism, and that did actually restrict Iran's nuclear program, it was facing a lot of criticisms. One of the big things that critics, especially Republicans, including Trump, accused Obama of doing was sending, and I quote, they said this a lot, pallets of cash to the Iranians. All these pallets of cash that Iran is going to use to fund terrorist activity, that total value was $1.7 billion, and it was returning frozen funds that Iran had used to buy American fighter jets when the Shah was in charge, that then after the Islamic Revolution, the U.S. didn't give the jets, but kept the money and kept the money frozen. So it was returning Iran's own money to them. One payment of $1.7 billion is a lot less than $100 billion every year.
Yes, I'll say so. Our friend David Dayan over at the American Prospect quipped after the agreement was announced on Tuesday that would seem to allow Iran to have complete control of the Strait and charge people to go through it. He quipped on Blue Sky, quote, "Surely the Strait of Hormuz will remain the only toll booth in global shipping and navigation around the world. No way it becomes a model for countries seeking independence and treasure." Does he have a point there about the standard, the model this could be setting moving forward elsewhere in the world?
Yes. And I think that that also gives people a sense of the degree of this loss, that the United States, as the world's premier power, was a guarantor of freedom of navigation. This is one of the big international principles, and that the U.S.-run world or U.S.-led world was able to guarantee, and that helped the United States get very powerful and very rich because countries saw this as a benefit and therefore acquiesced to American leadership in various ways. And also, the United States Navy was the premier military power of the Persian Gulf region from World War II on. And if anything holds like this with Iran in control of the strait, the U.S. has lost both of them. And that is, when I was trying to think of it, I think that might be the biggest strategic defeat in any American war ever. That when you compare it to something like, for example, Afghanistan and Vietnam, both of those are losses, but after a prolonged fight and one where the U.S. withdraws under fire, but doesn't do so by making a big concession to a geopolitical rival. And other things like 1812 or Korea are basically draws, where the United States also thwarted some of its rivals' goals. In this case, the only one who got their goals thwarted was the United States.
Yeah.
And by Iran being able to, if they can pull this off, if they can keep it going, if they're getting a big new source of revenue and they are gaining a bunch of regional control that they didn't have before, and they're making it where now every country in the world, especially anyone at least with any shipping interests in the region, including a lot of those Gulf states that are American partners, including the U.S. Navy, which has its fifth fleet in Bahrain, and I don't know how that's going to work if Iran controls the only waterway access, but that showed a lot of other countries that they can stand up to the United States. In fact, that the American century, American-led international system might be over, and that they can extract more things from it, that the United States is not actually this really powerful threat to them anymore.
And not only that, it seems to me that not only has Iran, you know, not ultimately had to give up much in the course of this war, even in, as I say, as we're understanding a best case scenario for what's been presented,
but
this war, not us, not us and Israel and so forth. But if Iran had begun the war, couldn't they claim a whole bunch of victories at this point with all of these things we've been discussing, all of these things that they seem to be sort of coming out better with at the end than they started with?
Yes, with the one big caveat that if Iran had started the war and if Iran had aggressively tried to cripple the global economy while demanding sanctions from the world, we likely would have seen a much bigger global reaction. There would have been tons of countries working together to either militarily force Iran to reopen the strait, to find ways to economically punish Iran, to make it a global coalition. And instead, what we had here, not only with the U.S. starting it and then making some and starting it without cause while saying a bunch of lies about imminent threats from 47 years ago or something, you know, not even making sense. But the United States didn't even give allies any advance notice, had been denigrating NATO allies and others for well over a year. At a little into the war, said, don't need anybody's help, and was really insulting to, British naval capacity or something. And then after, when it wasn't going well, Trump turned around and started demanding their help. And unsurprisingly, they're not helping. But if they had been, the United States would be in a decently stronger position. And even here, the Iraq war is a good contrast, because as much as there were many problems with that war and the start of it and how the U.S. conducted it, there were also a lot more international buy-in. The United States and George W. Bush had spent, and his administration, spent over a year making the case for war and had lined up British support and Polish support and Australian support, who all brought troops. And within 2 months after the start of the occupation, they had a UN resolution that was authorizing it and had a bunch more countries sending other in support. Or we can contrast it with Bush and then especially Obama with the pressure campaign against Iran that got them to agree to the JCPOA and got them to actually restrict their nuclear program, give up a lot of their enriched uranium, restrict their centrifuge capacity to make more. All of that happened because almost the entire world together sanctioned Iran. And Iran cut a deal not with the United States, but with the US and Russia and China and Europe and the UN and with other countries also supportive, India, Japan, other major countries all supportive. And that's what got Iran to actually make concessions. And so by Trump going in alone, he not only managed to get Iran a lot more sympathy, and this is just after they had slaughtered a lot of thousands of protesters.
Yeah.
So Iran, a lot of countries quite reasonably have big issues with the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. And right after they had all of this international negative PR from all of those massacres, and then the United States and Israel attacked them and did not have good cause for doing so and could not convince the world at all that they had good reason to do so. And that went from the international community being angry at Iran and wanting to perhaps pressure Iran over the massacres to then being more sympathetic.
Yeah.
And so the United States ended up flipping the public opinion about Iran and didn't even do any of the diplomatic work to secure international opinion in support of the war or in support of the United States. So it ended up being decently less support than the U.S. had when invading Iraq and much more sympathy for Iran than they would have gotten if they were the ones who had started the war.
We really nailed it. Let's talk a little bit about this nuclear deal. You mentioned a little bit about the you know, Trump love and the Fox News and the folks on the right that, Obama gave them pallets of cash, paid them to take this deal, which has always been a ridiculous claim. But what in fact happened was Donald Trump came into office. He tore up the deal. He loves to claim he saved the world by tearing it up somehow, that the Middle East would be destroyed by now if it wasn't for him. Well, human rights attorney Kasim Rashid offered sort of a helpful summary of the Iran deal that was struck under Obama and now the ceasefire deal seemingly agreed to by Trump, as we have come to understand it. In the Iran deal by Obama, writes Rashid, the Strait of Hormuz was open for free. Iran had strict limits on uranium enrichment. Iran agreed to make no nuclear weapons. Iran allowed international inspectors to ensure compliance and inspectors to confirm Iran's full compliance, which they did. Contrast with the Iran ceasefire by Trump, the Strait of Hormuz is closed. It's only open for $2 million per ship, if at all at this point. We'll see. Iran makes no guarantee of limits on uranium enrichment, no guarantee of no nuclear weapons, no guarantee to allow international inspectors. And yet Trump's MAGA supporters today are claiming he's somehow playing 5D chess and it's all the art of the deal. Does Rashid have it just about right as you see it, comparing that side by side? Or is it more fair to say, hey, you know, negotiations do have to start somewhere. At least we are beginning to have a conversation.
Well, I guess it's better to be having a conversation than to be shooting at each other. But yes, he has that right. The deal in the 2010s was a long-term effort. It was bipartisan in the U.S., meaning both Bush and Obama led to it. Mm-hmm. And it was the sanctions first under Bush and then continuing the negotiations under Obama. It had built on some of the failures of attempted nuclear negotiations with North Korea. It had so much international support. It was extremely detailed. And one thing that stood out where even before the current war started, that where I was very skeptical that Trump would get any sort of agreement, because he sent his son-in-law and his real estate investor friend, and they didn't bring along any nuclear engineers or nuclear physicists or energy experts. So they were not even in the slightest position to be able to get the sort of details that the JCPOA had. So Trump originally, when he took office in 2017, in 2018, he reneged on the agreement. He let Iran out of nuclear restrictions in exchange for nothing. And what he made was his arguments, and the people who supported this said that they were going to put Iran under maximum pressure, and then it was going to get a much better deal, that either the Iranian government was going to collapse under sanctions and there would be this revolution that would lead to a democratic and pro-American and Israel-friendly government. And I don't know how they convinced themselves of that fantasy, but they did. And then there was a better argument from that version, at least one that is at least connected to plausibility, was that they would apply what they called maximum pressure. They would put on a lot more sanctions. They would make military threats. They might do some bombing. And the result of that pressure campaign, they argued, was going to get Iran to capitulate, to agree to a better deal, and something that had not just nuclear restrictions, but total abandonment of any nuclear activity. Mm-hmm. And that also gave up their missile activity. And that also gave up their support for various groups they support in the Middle East, and also got them to recognize Israel. This was always the pitch that if Obama had only been strong, that he would have gotten all of those things. And that one was always wrong. And this is just like the same thing with the pallets of cash, that, you know, you have to give something to get something. And it took a lot to get Iran to give up its nuclear program and to allow inspectors that were more intrusive than any other country has allowed. So that took quite a bit. And the result, though, of Trump of pulling out and then putting on this pressure campaign was Iran stepping its enrichment back up, of escalating tit for tat between the U.S. and Iran,
right,
of in 2025, of Trump launching airstrikes during Israel's 12-day war with Iran, joining it in launching airstrikes, which Trump then claimed, obviously lying, but claimed that Iran's nuclear program was totally and completely obliterated. And then less than a year later, he's back to try to do something about it, because obviously it wasn't obliterated. But it has, the maximum pressure did not get Iran to make concessions, in part because from Iran's perspective, they didn't make a deal with Obama and then not make a deal with Trump. They made a deal with the United States, and then the United States broke it, even though Iran was still following it. And then in this year, when the U.S. started this war, that Trump's people were negotiating. So it was Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff were talking to Iranian representatives. And then the U.S. started the war, even as Iran, according to the leaders in Oman, that Iran was making some concessions, was at mm-hmm. least showing some movement on their negotiating. Mm-hmm. So with all of that, the Trump administration, in both terms combined, but especially this one, effectively convinced Iran that he, especially in the United States in general, is totally untrustworthy and can't possibly agree to any sort of agreement. And we're seeing that in the way that they're talking about this potential ceasefire deal, why they didn't make any concessions, in part because they don't trust that the United States will hold up its end of the bargain, especially while Trump is president.
Yeah.
And they don't trust, and they can't trust, that if they did make concessions, that the U.S. and Israel wouldn't just come and bomb them again in a few months or in a year. And so they're trying to maximize their leverage using the Strait of Hormuz. And Trump walked right into it and handed them this really big card that they could play, and which they have played and generated a lot of leverage for, and will not be giving up, no matter how much he yells at them, no matter how much he lies and claims that they're making concessions and it was a success, because they have that hard power now and they need it to continue hedging against potential U.S. attack.
Not only can he not be trusted, it seems, during negotiations to actually, you know, continue with those negotiations, to actually keep any particular agreement, it seems like we've also given up, well, at least Trump has, you know, this notion that when he makes these threats, he's going to carry them out. Apparently, when he makes these threats, he almost never carries them out. And we've seen this time and time again here. On the nuclear piece, Nicholas Grossman, prior to Trump's initial attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities last June, the ones in which he claimed to completely obliterate the possibility of Iran ever having a nuclear weapon. It was reported that satellite photos showed trucks leaving with some of these facilities with scuba-sized containers believed to contain enriched uranium at the time, before the bombing began, and that about 1,000 pounds of uranium enriched to 60%, I think about 90% is needed to create a bomb, and another 10,000 pounds enriched to, I think it was 30%, may have been removed from those nuclear facilities that were subsequently bombed by Trump and Israel at the time. So it's unclear if that nuclear material is actually buried beneath the rubble, as Trump insists, or if it has escaped into the wild. Do you know anything about that? What should we know about it? What should we fear about it? Is there any reason to have confidence that, in fact, the material has not escaped into the wild at this point?
So we can't really know from afar. You know, that's the sort of thing that even intelligence agencies with access to all sorts of technology and information that we don't have don't really know. But as best I can tell from the public reports on it, there is a possibility that Iran shipped some of it out, that they moved some of it out of the facilities that the U.S. bombed last year, and in part because Trump had telegraphed that attack, was, you know, talking about it very openly for a couple of weeks, and that's when some of the satellite photos picked up trucks moving back and forth. There have also been a lot of reports from a variety of sources that say that at least a lot of Iran's uranium, enriched uranium, is buried at one of these sites, that they had it underground and a lot of the top and the access way was buried. And that also, that makes it both almost impossible for the United States to go and get it in war conditions, and also that Iran just has to dig it up. But even more broadly, you can't bomb knowledge. Uranium enrichment and nuclear bombs are old technology. Oppenheimer was, you know, this big hit movie that gave you quite a bit of details on uranium enrichment and plutonium enrichment, or sorry, a plutonium bomb and how to make different structures of a bomb and how to do it. You can find this stuff on Wikipedia. The issue is not really, so you can't bomb the knowledge away. And the Iranians have been doing this for a while. So even as during times when Israel in particular had a campaign of assassination against Iranian nuclear scientists, there are always others who can do it. So they know the process. They know how to make the stuff. They have uranium mines in the country. They can always do it again. And so the material itself that is in Iran is somewhat problematic. It's that could already make for a radioactive dirty bomb. It can be enriched just a little more to make a nuclear weapon. But the bigger problem overarching it is that Iran has a now even bigger incentive to try to get a nuclear weapon or to use things like its leverage over the Strait of Hormuz as a deterrent to pursue its further nuclear development. And the United States' best shot at that was the diplomacy under Bush and Obama and the JCPOA. And by throwing that away, Trump eliminated that, closed off that diplomatic path. So even though he, and I heard Secretary of Defense Hegseth and some others, the press secretary that you mentioned, they might say things about how, you know, I don't know, Iran has no chance of nuclear weapon or whatever, just up is down lie. And they can say that, but that doesn't change the underlying reality that Iran has some uranium, some of it's enriched, they know how to enrich more, and now they will have both greater ability and greater incentive to do so.
It's all going very well, it sounds like, Nicholas. One last question for you here. There has been a lot more on the on your political science expertise, I suppose, than national security, although I think this is actually both. There's been a lot of talk since especially Trump's profane Easter Sunday threat to, you know, destroy Iran's civilian power plants and bridges and desalination plants, etc., that he is simply going insane amid all of this and that he needs to be removed from office. And that's not talk coming from, you know, lefties. It's coming from Trump allies like Alex Jones and Tucker Carlson and Candace Owen and Marjorie Taylor Greene and so forth, as much as it's coming from the left. Is it time, as Alex Jones said, to quote 25th Amendment his ass? And do you see any political path toward that end? How bad does this have to get? Does he actually have to launch a nuclear attack before any of that can actually happen, Nicholas?
I mean, that's a good question. I think I don't know how much I buy these type of big Trump fans or previous Trump fans saying that he's going insane or gone crazy. He looks pretty much the same to me that he's been, you know, maybe like he's lost a step. He, you know, seems like maybe a little mentally slower or, you know, a little older, but that to me, at least, it seems like the same deficits of character that we've seen there the entire time. And he issued threats kind of like this in other contexts too. It's just that he got himself into this a strategic situation where the U.S. has no good options and Iran has real leverage. And so it can't be something like tariffs where he imposes tariffs and then if he takes the tariffs away, things mostly snap back. And instead, with the war, he changed things too dramatically and can't walk back from it. But on the 25th Amendment, I'll say, look, I, as a big critic of the Trump administration, as somebody who really does not want him and all the way he's abusing stuff in power, it is heartening to hear people that had been a part of the Trump coalition now start to question it. But the 25th Amendment is supposed to be for presidential incapacitation, as in literally incapacitated, like the president just had a stroke. The only time that they have used it has been when the president has gone under anesthesia, such as for a colonoscopy, just to temporarily give it to the vice president. And so what the 25th Amendment effectively is just impeachment with extra steps. If the first half the cabinet has to say that the president is incapacitated and therefore unable to do his job. And mm-hmm. I would be absolutely shocked if half of Trump's sycophantic cabinet ever says anything like that. But even if they do that, then as long as the president is able to communicate to Congress that he's all he has to do is say, I'm awake, I can do the job. It doesn't matter if we think he can. As long as he can say that, then it would take 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the Senate to remove him. Whereas impeachment doesn't need half the cabinet, it's just half the House and needs 2/3 of the Senate. But even that has been too high a bar to clear with Trump, that clearly has a strong cult of personality around him, of a lot of even Republicans who are critical of him or who say they disagree with some of this stuff tend to express it, you know, privately or to leak it to a reporter, or whenever things really come to a fore, they demur or they're retiring from Congress, for example, instead of standing up to him and voting against him in a more explicit way. So the literal way to remove a president from power is via impeachment and via removal. That any 1/3 of the Senate can block it. It is very likely that MAGA Republicans will have at least that 1/3. And so at minimum, they're not even checking the president. They're abdicating a lot of the powers of Congress, letting him usurp the power of the purse, letting him break the law and violate the Constitution in numerous ways. And so I can't see any movement on anything like impeachment or, you know, 25th Amendment impeachment with extra steps. Can't see anything like that at minimum, unless Congress changes hands after the midterms. And even then, the Trump administration can probably hang on to power no matter how many laws they break, no matter how much they violate the Constitution. I'd say likely until end of 2028.
Nicholas Grossman with that good news. Nicholas Grossman is the international relations professor, political scientist, expert in terrorism insurgency, author of Drones and Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security at the University of Illinois. You can follow him on the Blue Skies at Nicholas Grossman, and you can and should sign up for his very insightful newsletter, ARC Digital at grossman.arcdigital.com. Dot media. Nick, really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you, sir. Look forward to speaking soon.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, all right, Desi Doyen, it was at this point, I believe, exactly yesterday, on yesterday's show, when all the news started breaking about the Middle East and the ceasefire and
the Taco
end of
Tuesday.
The Taco Tuesday, all of that stuff. So we better get out before anything like that happens again. I kind of blame myself. Anyway, thanks again to Nick Grossman. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can always download it for free at bradblog.com, where we have done a lot of work on the back end, by the way, of our server. If you've ever had problems getting to bradblog.com. Hopefully you will not anymore. Stop on by bradblog.com, and please, while you're there, consider hitting a donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves and to help us continue to improve the website. We're just a couple of weeks away now from a complete relaunch of bradblog.com. If all goes well, what could possibly go wrong?
And thanks to everyone who helped out to get it there.
Who continues helping out.
Yes.
Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, I am the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.